from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about our bones, which give our bodies structure and support, of course. But the science writer Brian Switek says they're more than that. Bone, he says, isn't just this hard, static substance. It's alive. Switek will join us to tell the story of bones, how they're basically evidence of how we managed to survive over the course of 500 million years. We'll be right back.
KUER's community calendar is a resource where you can find hundreds of events happening across Utah. You can learn a new skill in workshops, experience art and performances offered across the state, scout family-friendly events and activities, and a whole lot more. You can also share your own events. Just fill out the form. It's all on our website, KUER.org. Just click Community Calendar under the Events tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the course of writing his new book, the science writer Brian Switek says he inadvertently made himself a speaker for the dead. And it's not really such a grandiose statement when you think about the history of bone, which encompasses half a billion years of evolution. Switek's book goes way back to the beginning, to the first things that had something approaching what we now all recognize as bone. And then he moves us forward to how bone came to give us our structural core, how it grows and moves and how it repairs itself. But this is not just about anatomy. Switek also writes about the cultural history of bones, bones as relics and symbols. He says, bones hold clues about the lives we lead. His book is called Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. Brian Switek is going to be reading and signing his book at the King's English Bookshop. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. He's a freelance science writer whose work has appeared in National Geographic and Smithsonian, the journal Nature. He's written about fossils. He's written about dinosaurs. So it's not really that much of a stretch that he would take on the subject of bones. What is it about bones? Is it just, oh, look, here's evidence of these creatures. Here's evidence of this fascinating, complicated evolutionary past. Or is it the physical bone itself that interests you?
I mean, to me, and I think it's a very human thing overall, to be, you know, wandering out somewhere, you know, whether it's the woods or deserts here or somewhere else, and you see bones, you know, just lying on the ground, and they might be from something modern, they might be something ancient, but to ask, okay, what is that? What's it from? You know, how did it fit into the rest of the body? It's all these questions that kind of come tumbling out of this basic observation. You know, indigenous people throughout the planet, especially in North America, have noticed bones and fossils, you know, coming, spilling out of the ground long before paleontology and science existed. And they recognized, you know, these remnants as parts of living animals and things that aren't here anymore. And I think that really speaks to this fascination that we have. It's a basic level of curiosity. And it's great that we can learn about, you know, the grand scheme of evolutionary history and how our bodies work and, you know, where we came from. But I think if it's just that basic sort of science, just going, what is that? And pulling questions out from there.
One of the things you write about later in the book is that we have this long and complicated relationship with skeletons. I was really interested in that because you mentioned, this is how you put it in the book, we've been transfixed by bones for a really long time. Is that what it is? Is all the questions they inspire?
Absolutely. And I think it's the same for the human skeleton as it is for a dinosaur skeleton or anything else, that, you know, you come across, you know, this, you know, really beautiful scaffolding, this evolutionary architecture. And what that can say, that bones are not only about movement and about, you know, form and anatomy, but they're living time capsules that record, you know, the life of the organism that they're a part of. And once you start to assemble all these pieces together, you know, much like a skeleton itself, you start to get at this bigger picture. And some of these things, particularly with fossil bone, you know, we had no idea of some of these major concepts about life and biology before we started paying attention to them. For example, it wasn't until 1799 that the idea of extinction was really articulated in a meaningful way, and that came from mammoth and mastodon bones, looking at these ancient bones, saying, okay, these don't belong to anything alive today.
Where are they? Where did they go? Where did they go?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And this opens up this broader vista. Okay, there is a past, and it's different than it is today. Yeah. And all these things that come out of studying bones.
There's a section where I wanted to mention this before we back up, and that is human bones as objects of worship. Mm-hmm. You mentioned St. Bride's Church in London, for example. Talk a little bit about that, how we've come to revere bones.
In terms of spiritual beliefs and religion, you know, bones are often, you know, very symbolic of the afterlife, what's going to become of us. In the case of St. Bride's, it wasn't so much worshiping the bones themselves, but there's an ossuary in the church. So basically the parishioners that have, you know, had died over years and years and years are stacked in this particular array. And now it's sort of a gold mine for archaeologists who want to understand what were people like at the time, what pathologies or what injuries or illnesses did they suffer from, what were the demographics of the time. And some of these, you know, ossuaries, you know, elsewhere in the world, particularly in Europe, I think I refer to it in the book as it's like stepping into like David Cronenberg's foyer. It's like this body horror kind of experience with all these skulls staring back at you. But it's this also really, you know, powerful reminder of what we think of about the afterlife, that we want to leave something behind or kind of waiting for, whether that's salvation or whatever it is. You know, I'm a-religious, so I don't particularly feel the same way about my bones. But for a lot of people, especially in the Catholic Church, you know, where you have relics and the power that's imbued to them as ways to ask for intercession on your behalf, or your miracles that have been said to be performed, you know, by these, you know, relics or through these relics, that, you know, bones are really the most permanent. They're the part of ourselves that has the potential to last the longest. Once everything else sloughs away, they're still there, and they still carry a lot of personality, especially skulls. The fact that, you know, there are, you know, skull cups, for example, mm-hmm. people making cups out of skulls and drinking from them go back, you know, about 12,000 years or so or more, and have been invented and reinvented over and over again through different cultures. So whether it's, you know, a religious belief or a cultural practice or something like that, the fact is that we can look at the human skeleton and still see the person there.
So interested in the fact that you mentioned how what we're learning, or what we know about Neanderthals and mm-hmm. how they started burying their dead or inhuming their dead long before I think people really realized and thought, and which gave us a sense about how our species, or the earliest version of our species, had been thinking about death. And that, you say, it's evidence that we've been thinking about death for a very long time.
Yeah, and what that means and what we might need, you know, in the afterlife, that a lot of these Neanderthal burials have grave goods in them. And, you know, it's impossible to go back now and ask these people what these things meant to them. But the fact they're there, that it's some sort of significance, that it was something that, you know, that might have been of use to them, that we had, you know, beliefs that there might be something after for quite a long time, and to be prepared for that. And I focused on the Neanderthals in particular because for, you know, a long time, you know, really since their discovery in the 19th century, they're always characterized as very ape-like, backward people. Even today, like, to call someone a Neanderthal is an insult. You don't want to be called that. But the fact is, through, you know, recent analysis of their culture and their genetics, like, you and I are probably part Neanderthal. I haven't had my genetics done. I don't know if you have, but this is something that, you know, has been discovered, that, you know, they were once kept as the separate species, basically this proto version that we outcompeted. And it turns out that, you know, we intermixed with them, that, you know, many of us alive today are part Neanderthal, that they're, you know, a different expression of being human in the way that we are, and had their own cultural beliefs and ideas, including about, you know, what happens when life ends.
Yeah, they didn't just walk away from a body, it seems. There was some cultural meaning to it at some point along the way.
That's right, yeah. And that was some of this, you know, interpretive bias, I think, that existed for quite a while. And this is a theme that comes up over and over again in Skeleton Keys, is that, you know, science isn't we found a fact and we're going to put it on a shelf and now we know this and then we move on to the next thing. It's this dance of fact and theory that's constantly going on. And the expectations that you have going into something will influence the data you collect, how you interpret that data, what you think about it. So when we were thinking about Neanderthals as, you know, basically these backward 8 people. Some of these initial burials, when they were found, was thought, well, this is just a body that they threw in a cave and these rocks fell on it and everything's accidental. But once our view of them started to shift and you know, these views that we have of their culture now, the cave paintings that were always attributed to our direct predecessors, it was thought that Neanderthals didn't do this. It turns out that some of the oldest cave paintings that we have in Europe were probably made by Neanderthals. Yeah. And it's this kind of rehabilitation of their image. So once we're open to the possibility that things are a bit different, all these pieces that didn't make sense before start to click and we see them in a new way.
Yeah. Okay, I want to back up and start talking about how bone evolves, mm-hmm. how it develops. Mm-hmm. Before we jump into that, though, I do want to mention something that you write about. You write in the book that you worry that in looking at the structure and, you know, the order of bones, that science sometimes misses what you say is the whole truth of the animal, the, as you describe it, the poetic, elusive nature of the creature. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so if you look in any textbook about what bone is, you'll get a definition saying that it's a combination of collagen and hydroxyapatite, which is a mineral. So that's basically the flexible part and the hard part that makes our bones, you know, so structurally resilient and important. Mm-hmm. So that's getting down to – it's a very reductionist sort of view. What's the least common denominator that explains all these things? But it's also kind of unsatisfying mm-hmm. in that, okay, that's the composition of what bone is, but it doesn't, you know, tell us why a femur is – or a thigh bone is so good at supporting weight, or why our vertebrae look very similar to one another and how that happened, or why we have, you know, 4 limbs instead of just 2 or 6 or 8 or some other number, or, you know, all the expressions of bones that exist, you know, everything from a blue whale, you know, that's something that's, you know, over 100 feet long and, you know, almost as many tons, you know, largest animal that's ever lived, down to these little frogs that are about the size of a fly that also have skeletons inside them. All these expressions of bone that's it's easy to lose. So there is value in coming down with, okay, what is bone, what joins it together, but it's not the whole story, and we can miss quite a bit if we're only looking for a sort of biological equation. It's something that has come up over and over again since really the 1700s. It's physics envy that, you know, when physics is like, we can explain the universe with an equation, all the other science is like, well, I want to do that too, and we have this urge to reduce things to its simplest parts, and there is some value to that, but we have to also recognize that that's not the whole picture.
Yeah. You write about – we were just talking about the fact that you started with this interest in dinosaur bones. But then – and you mostly ignored human bones, you said, for a long time. And you write this in your book, if I didn't know human skeletons, I didn't really know myself. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I was kind of focused on these prehistoric monsters for a long time. You know, and part of it might just come from, you know, childhood love of monster movies and other things, still a Godzilla fan after all these years. But, you know, I always thought humans were kind of boring. You know, I they're kind of plain. You know, we don't have horns or spikes or crests or, you know, neat fins or, you know, sails or any of these other like bizarre appendages that really attract us to, you know, the megafauna of eras past or even animals today, like compared to something like a cheetah, we look kind of plain.
Yeah.
But it really struck me when I was taking a human anatomy class at Rutgers University, and there was a human skeleton that they had, you know, just all the parts labeled, reconstructed, you know, just as an instructional tool. And I was really looking at the joints, like how the shoulder blade connected to the rest of the body and how it's barely on there. It's barely connected by anything. Or the elbow joint has all this detail of this biological hinge, and realizing that I didn't really have any idea about how this worked in myself. And what I viewed as plain was really actually quite unusual. There's nothing else quite like us alive today. I mean, even amongst other, you know, apes, other primates that, you know, we're related to, we're very, very strange. And a lot of the sort of aches and pains and things that we feel in day-to-day life, you know, owe to the fact that we have this unusual history, and that in, you know, about 3.5 billion years of life on Earth, there's not been another animal quite like us. The human skeleton is really quite strange.
And the, as we'll get to this too, and the happenstance mm-hmm. that got us to this point. You mentioned these sort of evolutionary contingencies mm-hmm. that brought us, as you say, 4 limbs now. Mm-hmm. But we could have had 6. We could have had one big one or whatever. But I don't want to get into that yet. Well, let me back up. This is one thing that I think is really important to say early on too, is everyone thinks of bone as being hard, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But you talk about how bone is lively and responsive as skin. And we don't think of it as being flexible. We don't think of it as being this like really amazing building material. Why is that, you think? Because we see it after it's desiccated or something?
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes we only see bone, you know, either after death or, you know, in the case when I broke my wrist when I was 10, I got an x-ray, you know, my wrist showing my bones inside me.
Yeah.
But we don't think about them that much. And it's one of these things where it's similar to how it's difficult to get our heads around the concept of things like geologic time and that, like, time frames that aren't ours, that in the course of a human life, like right now, the bones inside you and I are actually very busy. You know, there are bones that are laying, there are bone cells that are laying down new bone material. There are cells that are eating up old bone material. They're shifting. It's at a rate where some bones in our skeletons, they turn over just about completely about every 10 years.
Wow.
You know, they're very, very busy structures. And if you look at somebody like the flipbook version of their life from the time that they're born to the time that they die or in old age, you know, you can see how bodies grow and change.
Yeah.
And change shape. You know, the fact that we start out with about 260 bony pieces as an infant that coalesce into about 206 more or less as adults. But even then, it's not like we're just set and we're like, yeah, that for the rest of our lives. You know, many of us, you know, unfortunately experience things like osteoporosis, which is, you know, the bone eating cells being too active or the bone cells that are laying down new material not being active enough or both. But that changes the shape of our skeleton, our stature and you know, the physical nature of ourselves. So if you're able to like make those individual jumps or do that flipbook version, you can see, okay, yeah, there's something inside of us that's very dynamic and changing quite a bit, but it's just slow enough that we,
yeah,
don't fully appreciate it.
Yeah, you think of your skin as sloughing off and then reforming and, you know, regenerating. You think of cells as doing that. But mm-hmm. I don't think most of us think of bones as doing that.
Right, because they seem relatively static.
Yeah,
it
seems like it's just sitting there.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and it's not. I have to say, it is one of my favorite lines in the book. Bone is busy.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I just like to sit, like, especially when I'm like in an airport, I'm just waiting for something or I'm out in the field, you know, I've got a spare minute. I just like to sit and think about the bones in my skeleton, like just try and see if I can sense, you know, where they are, what they're doing, you know, maybe turn my wrist over and back and think about the way that my radius, that's one of the lower arm bones, rolls over the other lower arm bone that gives me that flexibility. You know, it's a slightly creepy experience, but I like it. You know, it's something that's alive, and I love the fact that, you know, bones by themselves don't move. You know, just a pile of, you know, an articulated skeleton can't move by itself, but a pile of muscle couldn't move by itself either. It's this constant push and pull that it's another tissue system in the body that's, you know, just as dynamic as anything else.
Brian Sweetek, his book is Skeleton Keys: The Secret Life of Bone. He's going to be reading and signing from the book at the King's English Bookshop tonight at 7. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West, so thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the science writer Brian Sweetek. We're talking about his latest book. It's called Skeleton Keys: The Secret Life of Bone. Okay, so in order to understand the story fully, we have to go back. We have mm-hmm. to go way, way, way back, like hundreds of millions of years back. You write about this critical character in the story of bones. Mm-hmm. This is 530-some-odd million years mm-hmm. ago, this creature that now is manifested in a fossil called the Picea gracilens?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Talk about this. It's not even an animal yet. It's a doodle, I think you said. It's a squiggle.
Yeah. It is an animal, but it's this sort of protovertebrate little fishy squiggle thing. It's initially identified as a worm.
Yeah.
It was like not very much different from the sandworms that are, you know, down at the shore. And, you know, there are other protovertebrates that I could have picked, but I picked this one in particular because I love its story and the environment that it lived in and the lesson it sort of teaches us. So Pikaia, it didn't really look very impressive at all. It's just this tiny little wormy thing. It had its sensory organs bound up at the front of its head, and it had what's called a notochord running along its back. So this sort of flexible forerunner of a spine. And already that's pretty impressive because that's the basic – that explains like why our backbones are at our backs rather than our fronts.
Just underline that. So when we look at elaborate spines of blue whales or human beings.
Yeah.
You can trace that structure some way back to that little squiggle some way.
Yeah, that's right. And if that, you know, notochord had been elsewhere in the body, if it had been arranged differently or at the belly side, then we might have that bony column that's holding us upright towards the front, or our bodies might be very different. You know, so already this is this idea of contingency, that evolution has certain sort of doorways that open and close based upon past events. That's not anything can happen day all the time, or there isn't a sense of destiny to it. It's that there are these possibilities that are constantly opening, shutting as life goes on. So the fact that, you know, this animal, Pikaia, had its sensory organs, you know, wrapped up at the front of the head instead of distributed throughout the body, that explains like why we have our, you know, eyes and nose and ears and, you know, jaws like all wrapped up in our heads instead of scattered throughout the rest of our body, why our backbone is at the back. And, you know, you would think, you know, we'd have the sort of temptation to look at an animal like this and say, like, of course this is destined to be great. This is a winning body plan. We can look at the, you know, next 530 million years and see all the things that vertebrates eventually become. But the fact is that this animal lived during a time where, you know, arthropods ruled. I mean, technically they still do. They outnumber us by quite a bit.
Yeah.
But protovertebrates are the forerunners of what would become the first vertebrate animals, the first animals with bone. They were very rare. They're tiny. They're marginal. If you looked at the animals, you know, in these environments, the Burgess Shale in Canada, famous fossil site, it's like, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing come to life. It's all, you know, segmented appendages and, you know, spikes and shutter-like mouths and compound eyes and things like that. And it really was a kind of luck that protovertebrates were able to survive and persist along these animals for tens of millions of years and then eventually, you know, start to flourish into the first fish and like sort of, you know, go along some of those other steps.
You know, Brian, it made me think of that. It kind of leads to these mind-blowing scenarios of what if. Like, what if the Pikaia hadn't evolved like it did? Or what if mammals, you know, how would mammals have then evolved, I mean, over time? And how would creatures have become humans? How would they have been constructed? I mean, under certain contingencies, I mean, we mentioned this earlier. I mean, we didn't have to have four appendages. Like we said, I mean, it makes you wonder, what if the chordates, these original early creatures, had gone extinct?
Yeah. Life on Earth would be incredibly different.
And you say incredibly smaller, you think, the creatures.
Probably. You know, but who knows? It's one of those things, if things are different, they'd be different.
Exactly.
But you know, we know, you know, from other time periods, so the Carboniferous, for example, when arthropods, you know, came out onto land, there, you know, millipedes that were 6 feet long and dragonflies about the size of a crow, that, you know, based upon the different conditions, that, you know, invertebrates got quite a bit bigger. But there wouldn't have been the same, you know, you wouldn't have had anything the size of like the biggest dinosaurs. You wouldn't have the insect equivalent of a T-Rex or something like that. You know, life would have, you know, been quite a bit different, you know, but who knows, you know, if something like vertebrates would have evolved again or if an endoskeleton would have appeared for some other reason. But I mean, it really brings up those possibilities. Like, how would things be different? Even small changes. You know, as you were just saying that, I was thinking about the fact that we've got bones in our ears. We often forget about this. We've got this three-piece set of tiny, tiny bones, the incus, the malleus, and the stapes, that are in our inner ears that, you know, allow us to hear sound. And those are old jaw bones. So if you think of an animal like Dimetrodon, you know, this famous thing is often mistaken for a dinosaur, the snail, sailback snappy thing. They often find dinosaur sets. It's actually closer relative to us than to reptiles.
Wow.
And in the tooth-bearing part of the jaw, that's something called the dentarine. Behind that, there are all these other bones, basically this jigsaw puzzle of other bones behind that. And those are the bones that eventually became smaller and migrated into the inner ear, because not only was it an advantage to have that tooth-bearing part of the jaw basically be stronger by just being that one piece, like our mandible, that's right now, like our lower jaw is just one piece of bone. But all those smaller bones, they were good for sound conducting, since there was some flexibility to them. So with vibration, you know, there's this sort of double push that there's an advantage to feeding, there's an advantage to picking up sound. But what if that didn't happen?
Yeah.
You know, we might be resting our chins on the table right now, hearing these low-frequency vibrations of us communicating. We might be bellowing at each other at, you know, over this interview rather than talking like we are now.
So when does the actual first whatever version of bone it is, when does this first show up? It's something like, what, 455 some odd million years ago.
Yeah, about 455 million years ago. And it took a little while to wrap my head around it at first because it's a material called aspidin. And it's a forerunner of bone, but it's acellular. And I thought about that for a while. Like, what is acellular bone? That doesn't make much sense to me because our bones are made of cells. You know, cells are organized into tissues, into systems, you know, the basic biology stuff that we all learn. It's basically like teeth. The first bone was basically like the cement-like protective structure that was on the outside of these fish that looked like living Roombas, basically. It's like this armor casing with a little tail sticking out the back. And there wasn't a jaw yet, just there'd be this little pinhole at the front that they'd suck up little materials through. But that's how bone started. It wasn't an internal scaffolding. It was armor on the outside to protect against some of these, you know, arthropods and other creatures that were trying to crunch on the descendants of things like Pikaia.
So it starts external. Do we know at what point it starts to become internal structure?
Shortly thereafter. So there's something about the way that bone becomes mineralized that it allowed the endoskeleton to start to, you know, not just be cartilage, to take on, you know, this more harder mineralized form. And we see this, you know, even our own skeletons today. You know, there's a whole section of the book about pathologies and the fact that we can get bone growing in places where it shouldn't. Like, people even had bone growing in their salivary glands, for example, oftentimes because of an injury or something that happens. Basically, calcium salts that are related to bone growth, they might appear in your soft tissues. So you'll have soft parts of your body start to turn to bone with age or with injury. So this goes back to probably this evolutionary transition where bones start on the outside. And then whatever allowed that bone to grow, it started to grow internally as well. Unfortunately, we can't study these organisms directly, check their physiology and how they're growing up. But it seems that once bone appeared, it was co-opted into this other role. And eventually we wound up, you know, our endoskeleton ended up being the sort of remains of this external armor.
It seems like the jaw was an important part of the story.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So prior to the evolution of the jaw, you just have these things that were like, you know, sort of like a box turtle shell with the tail sticking out of the back of it. And they couldn't really control what was going into their mouths, or you know, they couldn't really pump water over their gills like we see some fish and sharks doing today. So the jaw was not only important for, you know, feeding and, you know, being able to catch prey more efficiently, but even just things like breathing. Even now, you know, if you run, you know, and you start breathing through your mouth, you feel your jaw working and how that, you know, assists you in breathing. So, you know, this just simple hinge at the front of the face, it made a huge difference in, you know, the history of vertebrate evolution.
What did the paleontologist Neil, I think it's Shubin,
that's right,
what did he mean when he said we're all still fish?
Well, some of this goes into the philosophy of like how we organize the tree of life. So if you go back far enough, if you start with humanity and you go along the fossil trail, you know, we are, you know, primates, we're mammals, we're tetrapods, and that we have four limbs. But a lot of like our basic construction on the inside is the same as fish that were living, you know, 400 million years ago or more. That, you know, the way that we nest these rankings, that, you know, technically, like I remember in elementary school learning, you know, here are the five, you know, classes of vertebrate life. There are, you know, fish and amphibians and reptiles and mammals and birds. Well, basically they're all fish because they all are descended from fish, and there's not a ton of difference between the basic layout of our skeleton and things that, you know, look like lungfish or coelacanth that were swimming around about 400 million years ago. That all the major innovations that needed to happen in terms of the evolution of the jaw, the evolution of the endoskeleton, you know, having four limbs, you know, all these things showed up by then. After that, it's mostly been just a matter of tweaking in one way or another.
I'm so fascinated. There's so many different – you mentioned ears, which I was fascinated, and you write about that in the book. Ankles you write about. You seem to have a real interest in the elbow. That's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah.
The kneecap. How did we get a kneecap? Do we know?
The how is a difficult question because that requires something of a time machine. But it's – I mean, I love kneecaps, or patellae, I guess, is the technical term for them, because they're not attached to our skeleton any direct – way, and that they're inside a tendon. They're inside soft tissues. There's what's called a sesamoid bone. And we have sesamoid bones in different parts of our body. That's where some of the variable around 206 comes from for the count of human skeleton, because some of us have these little tiny seed-like bones and tendons in our foot or our hand, and other people don't. But everybody has kneecaps. And it makes moving and walking a lot more efficient the way that tendon works. There's a little neat experiment that a biomechanics lab did where they basically had these two little, you know, pieces of wood and sort of a little string running over them. And without the kneecap, it was very difficult to move that little lower part of the leg up. But once you, you know, add that little basically bulb of bone there, add some mechanical advantage, it becomes much easier to do that. And kneecaps have evolved multiple times, you know, amongst birds, amongst mammals, amongst, you know, reptiles. So it's something that we're not entirely sure, you know, why it showed up and got locked in. But once it did, it provided definite advantage to moving around.
I want to ask you about something you write that I have to say really surprised me. You would think that, and this is the question of what we can tell about a creature's sex, humans being sexed through a skeleton. I figured it would just be pretty straightforward. You look at that skeleton, that's female. You look at that skeleton, that's male. But you're uneasy about that. You're uncomfortable on some level. Not you're, as you put in the book, you're not comfortable using popular terms. You're not comfortable claiming bones as being able to identify actual biological sex. That really surprised me. Explain this.
Yeah. So if you want to identify, you know, let's say you find a skeleton somewhere, for forensic anthropologist, you know, has a body brought in, and the way that you would tell whether that body was osteologically or physiologically male or female are bones in the hips. That basically the way that our species, you know, delivers children makes that difference, where in osteological females they'll be a bit wider and in osteological males they'll be a bit narrower. So you'd think that skulls would help us because, you know, that's something that's very human to do. You're walking down the street and you're very, okay, that's a man, that's a woman, that's, you know, we make these judgment calls all the time. But there's such great variation in that. Like, I was really struck by it. You know, oddly enough, I was looking for a skull cast to put on my desk so I can look at the different bones that make up our skulls. Yeah. And there are a bunch of these. There are some standardized ones, but there are also skulls that are based, they're cast from actual people. But many of these didn't have their demographic information with them. So it'd be something like, you know, this is a, you know, Eastern European male, or this is, you know, a male from Southeast Asia or something like that. But they'd have this list of other traits that don't fit, that all these things are incredibly variable. So the only really way to tell osteologically male versus female is these bones in the hips. But this is something that, you know, is very personal to me. Like in recent years, you know, I've come to understand I'm a gender fluid person. Mm-hmm. I don't like, you know, whenever I have to fill out a form and I see, you know, choose man or woman on it, and the way that sex and gender oftentimes get confused, that they're, you know, very different things. So if somebody found my skeleton, they'd be able to say, okay, osteologically and therefore physiologically in terms of, like, you know, the hormones in my body and the way that I grew, I'm a male.
Yeah.
But if they reconstructed me, you know, as, you know, a dude, as a macho man, they'd be missing part of that picture. That's not what my gender is or my gender expression is.
Yeah.
And that's something I feel we get into dangerous territory in, you know, sort of stories about who, especially, you know, people who lived, you know, during the Ice Age or earlier, about who they were, because oftentimes, you know, a skeleton will be found to say, okay, this is osteologically female. We're going to give them a name like La Brea Woman. And this whole story that gets
– or Kennewick Man.
Right, right. Yep. That gets created, or Narikotomy Boy, or any of these people. This whole story about who they were, how they fit into their social life and everything, that we don't have any direct evidence for, because all that cultural stuff and their self-expression didn't get preserved with their bones.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, kind of feeds into – this idea of, you know, that sex and gender are in the same, and this, you know, binary, you know, just has existed for all time, and that we can, you know, basically tell these people who they were when we don't know. And I think it's important to say when we don't know things and how far the evidence can go, because that's what, you know, allows us to open our minds a little bit more and question some of the assumptions that we've always made.
Well, it seems like that's a theme in the book, is you have to look further than just what's right there, because there's all of these cultural dimensions, there's all these other kinds of dimensions that by just looking at a bone you can't really read.
That's right. Yeah. That's one of the, you know, the wonderful things about bones and sort of the trapping that we can sometimes get into when, you know, we don't question our own theories about who people were, or sort of, you know, ideas about how nature works, is, you know, there's the structure of the bone, how it fits. You can look at somebody's injuries and their pathologies. You can cut into the bone and see, you know, how they were growing. You can look at chemical isotopes to see what people were eating or drinking. You know, there's all these different levels, and it really depends what lens are we looking at this skeleton through. Are we looking at a human skeleton through the lens of, you know, an evolutionary biologist and seeing its connections to past life? Are we looking through it as a forensics expert looking for injuries or signs of where this person, you know, sort of came from or what cultural group they belong to? Or, you know, what lens are we using to look at human skeletons? It's different, and what we take away from a skeleton, the lessons that we learn, will vary based upon what our perspective is.
We were talking earlier about how bone is a busy substance, as you put it. And it's basically this constant sort of shifting, this a teardown operation is how you describe it in the book. And there's this process of how it forms, endochondral ossification. Did I get that right?
Yeah, endochondral. Yes.
Endochondral.
So basically inside cartilage is what that means.
So it's cartilage and then it becomes bone. So there's this process of development. Talk a little bit about this because I'm really interested in the section of the book where you discuss kind of the history of people co-opting that process, shaping skulls. Here's another cultural dimension to the actual process here.
Yeah, that, you know, our bones are, you know, quite active, especially when we're children, we're growing up, and, you know, our not all our bones are fused yet, particularly in our skulls. That's, you know, the classic, you know, don't drop the baby on its head thing because their skull has not fully fused yet and it's not protecting the brain fully. So, you know, in many cultures, you know, throughout, you know, North America, Asia, you know, other parts of the world, there'd be different ways of head binding. And this would be like a, you know, a fashion statement in some ways. You'd see it show up and then start to spread as certain cultural groups and move around the planet where, you know, through, you know, boards or bandages or, you know, string, you know, whatever method they use, it's possible to change the shape of the skull. And it has no effect on intelligence or anything like that.
That surprised me, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. But keep going.
Yeah. That, you know, we'd think so. Like, you know, we think about people, you know, bigger is better, right? You know, a big brain or a different, you know, skull shape, you know, indicates someone must be really smart. And it's not tied to that at all. My personal favorite example is coarsening, because that's that classic myth of, you know, coarsening was related to, you know, consumption and all these diseases. You know, consumption is basically tuberculosis. It's nothing to do with coarsening or bones. But coarsening over a long time can change the shape of a skeleton. It looks kind of gnarly when you look at it, that the spines coming off the vertebrae can kind of get shifted slightly out of place, that ribs develop these like drooping S-loop kind of shapes. You look at a skeleton of someone who had been corseted for quite a long time, you're like, oh, that looks like it must have been really awful. We think there must be something pathological, you know, related to it.
And it must have screwed up their biology in some way.
Right, but it turns out not.
Yeah.
So, you know, skeletons are incredibly malleable and incredibly, you know, resilient and able to change in pretty dramatic ways. It's mostly the bones of, you know, the feet and the hands. If you change those, then you start to get into trouble because we use them all the time for the biomechanics.
Yeah, you mentioned feet binding, for example, in some cultures. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that's an example and why that's so damaging. But other sorts, like, you know, changing the shape of the head or the changes that come along with coarsening, our skeletons can easily accommodate those changes.
I want to talk about the section in the book where you mentioned that you mentioned Lucy. Explain who this is. I mean, what I found interesting is you say that if you were to put a sort of a modern human skeleton up against Lucy, that people would be able to see the resemblance. Just talk about this part because I thought this was really interesting.
Yeah, so Lucy is the most famous example of a prehistoric human called Australopithecus afarensis that lived in ancient Ethiopia, you know, around about, you know, I think like 3.5 million years ago or so. And they were quite a bit smaller than us. They're more on the stature of like a modern day chimpanzee, but they're really interesting because there's sort of this mosaic of features that are sort of in between our past and what humans eventually became, and that the upper body has very long arms, so these curved fingers, this flaring rib cage that would have supported a large gut because they're still eating mostly, you know, vegetables and fruit, this sort of fermenting vat. So the upper body is very much...
They're not cooking by this point, right?
Not as far as we know.
Yeah.
No. You know, they might have done things like, you know, hunting, you know, small animals with like sticks and things like that, but not cooking with fire or anything. That came, you know, much later.
Yeah.
But the lower half of the body is very much like us in that you have these flaring hips to support all that viscera inside the body cavity, that the legs are straight up and down, and that, you know, we have trackways that have been found in you know, the same areas that we get the fossil bones from, that show that these people were walking upright and, you know, sometimes walking together, and that, you know, they weren't dragging their knuckles or going down on all fours. So that these beings that were sort of in between the past and the trees and a life spent entirely on the ground. And, you know, I find it kind of interesting, you know, that the juxtaposition between their skeletons and ours, because I think traditionally in physical anthropology that we tend to emphasize differences, saying, okay, you know, this, you know, Lucy is very different from Homo erectus, and Homo erectus is very different from us, and these are all the different features. But like we've been talking about, I got my start in this sort of science from thinking about other animals like dinosaurs and you know, all the other critters that lived before humans. And, you know, the changes between, you know, a raptor-like dinosaur and the first bird, or, you know, the first, you know, four-legged deer-like thing that was the, you know, an early whale, you know, as they were transitioning in the water. Those changes that happened about the same amount of time, about, you know, 10 million years worth of changes or so, are far more dramatic than between the first fossil human and us. So, you know, it'd be really easy to, you know, if you could lay out all these skeletons together, say, oh yeah, look, of course we're all part of one family. You know, you can pick out, you know, little bits of differences related to, you know, the way they moved or habitats they lived in, but it's not nearly as dramatic as some of these other iconic changes.
You write about the way bone evolves, the evolutionary trade-off, for example, you describe where we basically had to change, or our evolution changed our feet. We made this trade-off from grasping in trees to walking on the ground. That was another one of these sort of evolutionary processes. But you say that one of the questions you're interested in is, what happens when humans, it seems like this is where we're headed, go to Mars? What happens when we go to space? Because bones, you say, thrive on physical activity. So what happens? And I think that what's so fascinating about that is you're not looking back then in the evolution of bones, is you're looking forward about how bones are going to have to change and adapt to all of this. Talk a little bit about this and how, as you mentioned, bears have kind of figured this out.
Yeah, so bones require you know, physical activity. They require push and pull in order to, you know, continue to grow properly and thrive. If there isn't that pull there, bones basically start to eat themselves. You start to lose your bone mass. And we've seen this with, you know, people who've gone up on, you know, some of these sort of vessels that maintain, you know, their low orbit, you know, zero G for months on end. They lose their bone mass, you know, month by month. The thing is, something like, you know, 1% or so of their bone mass, you know, each month gets winnowed away. So if we're going to travel to other planets, this is one of the things that we need to figure out, not just, you know, who's going and having the supplies and all that stuff, but how to deal with the fact that if there are prolonged periods of weightlessness or outside of gravity, how to maintain bone strength so we don't just crumple the first time that we step onto Mars or whatever other planet it is. And, you know, black bears, you know, they're probably just coming out of their hibernation now, you know, around our neck of the woods.
Yep.
But they have these specialized biochemicals that basically keep them in a kind of stasis where their bones aren't eating themselves, where, you know, the bone isn't, the calcium isn't being shot back out into the bloodstream and being jettisoned, that they're able to maintain. And basically when they wake up, they're not all in this weakened sort of state. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting, you know, it came out a number of years ago, but Pixar's movie WALL-E actually went
came to mind immediately. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That basically the reason that, you know, the humans in that movie, you know, on the space station that's been out there forever are kind of, you know, bulbous and wobbly, like, isn't just, you know, supposed to be a commentary on, you know, sort of American weight gain. It's supposed to be like, this is what happens to your skeleton if you stay out there for too long.
You write about how bones respond to injury, which seems extraordinary. Talk a little bit about the story of the trepanation in the Incan Empire of Peru. This was really interesting too.
Yeah, that you know, the same processes that allow our bones to grow and to maintain themselves are also related to how our bones respond to injury. So you break a bone and immediately, you know, the tissue starts to respond. It might become a little inflamed. It might, you know, create a sort of bulb as it heals itself. But eventually, you know, those pieces will be brought back together in most cases. Although in some cases they're not. If you have a complete break and it doesn't join back together again, you get what's called a false joint. So your bone will try and, you know, reach out, you know, through your soft tissues to connect to that other part. So you might end up with a joint where there wasn't one before. But in terms of trepanation, that was basically, it's it wasn't early brain surgery because, you know, the Inca people weren't trying to get at the brain, but it's thought that, you know, a lot of the weapons that they used or a lot of the injuries that they suffered were from sort of blunt force damage. So, you know, someone get hit in the head by something and there'd be a shard of bone sticking in there. So this is a way of sort of cutting around the bone and getting those broken pieces out. And there are experts at this. I think their success rate was something over like 80%. And we measure that by the fact that most of the skulls that have been found with these, you know, trepanation marks on them show signs of healing, so that the patient survived the procedure long enough for the bone to start to heal and start to go back over that patch all over again. And, you know, you can track this through time, that how the, you know, surgeons doing this got better and better as time went on. But, you know, again, it's a testament to the sort of resilience of bone, that you think you take off a piece of your skull and that's gone, that's going to be a problem. But immediately the bone knows what's going on. It starts to try and bridge that gap.
We were referring to this earlier. It's a big question you raise about what is it, particularly when you're talking about indigenous people, who owns those skeletons? Who should be in charge of that? And so let's talk about a little bit about that, because as you mentioned, science has basically normalized the collection, the study of ancient skeletons of indigenous people. And this gets us into a really dicey territory where racism comes into play, which we sort of talked a little bit about before. Talk a little bit about this part, because there's this, you know, and this hasn't gone away, but the trend of grave robbing and the kind of racism here, and who gets control of these skeletons once they're skeletons, you know?
That's right. And I think there's just a news story this week about, you know, an FBI seizure of human skeletons and indigenous people's artifacts. You know, the guy had been collecting them illegally for years and years and years. And you know, he's not alone. This is a problem that's well known. And it kind of comes down to, you know, this idea that got passed down from, you know, the 1700s on, that the dead have no rights, that basically, you know, dead is dead. And once somebody, you know, has passed away, their bones should be able to be collected and, you know, fodder for anthropological research. And the fact is that anthropology, particularly in America, started out as a racial science. And by that I mean, like, basically the fixation of anthropology was, what are the races of people and how do we divide those? And it was thought that there are basically five and you can shunt people here and there.
Which is nonsense, right?
Right. It's nonsense. Yeah. You know, race is a cultural construct.
Of course.
There's no biological basis for this whatsoever. Basically, that, you know, what we think of oftentimes as a race is a culture that, you know, you say you choose and they choose you back. But there's not a biological basis for this. There's no way to divide people into races on the base of their skeletons, certainly. It's the same thing that we were talking about, you know, osteological sex before. Mm-hmm. That if you look at skulls, like, there's much more variability than not. And it's sort of like, you know, to a hammer, the whole world's a nail. Like, if you set out these boxes and say, okay, I've got five, you're going to shove everybody into certain boxes, even if they don't fit into those. Mm. But this was the province of early American anthropology. And some of this as well, I mean, this is a, you know, complex story where, you know, sort of, you know, it started off as, you know, collecting and trying to organize people and ranking people. So it wasn't just this value list, okay, what exists in nature? It was like, okay, there are five groups of people and these are how we're going to rank them according to society and understand our history. Mm-hmm. Again, this goes back to the interplay between, you know, the data or what you observe and then how you're interpreting it. But there's also an aspect of, you know, doing this for other people's own good. So you saw this, you know, pick an analogy from another branch of science in conservation ecology. I was just at the American Museum of Natural History last week, and many of their, you know, African mammals in their African mammal hall were shot not just to have pretty displays, but because it was thought that these animals were going to go extinct. And if, you know, someone didn't go out and take these specimens and put them in a museum, we'd lose them forever. And, like, you know, by the time that, you know, by the 21st century, no one would know what a giraffe looked like or a gorilla looked like anymore. Mm-hmm. And some anthropologists and archaeologists, you know, through the 19th and early 20th century took this approach to indigenous peoples and other peoples as well, that this was like, well, this is for your own benefit. We're trying to save your culture and the records of it, not listening to the actual people themselves. And this is a conversation that really we're just starting to have, like, what does consent look like in these fields? And some progress has been made, but at the same time, it's very contentious. And there's a lot of, you know, just bad history, you know, going back to the origins of this field. And, you know, on the one hand, I felt like, okay, I'm kind of airing anthropology's dirty laundry here, but a lot of the racialized and racist, you know, beliefs that, you know, were promulgated, you know, during these time periods. You still hear them now, especially amongst social conservatives. And I wish these things weren't still relevant, but they are. And it's worth saying, okay, where does this come from? And when we talk about, okay, well, what races are, where does that come from as a construct, and how did that get, you know, sort of popularized, and why are we stuck with it? So I'm hoping that, you know, at least these parts of the book can at least further this conversation a little bit more, because it's going to take quite a long time to untangle.
Let me ask you finally, this was something you referred to earlier, is that you'd like to, from time to time when you have a quiet moment, to just sort of contemplate your bones. And you recommend other people do it as a kind of form of meditation. Make the case for that, because I really like this idea too.
Yeah, I think it, you know, connects us to ourselves and our past. You know, thinking about, okay, you know, as I'm talking to you now, I can even like close my eyes, think, okay, I've, you know, got my lower jaw, my mandible that's, you know, moving up and down as I'm talking to you, and all the soft tissues that are associated, the push and the pull of all those different things. But, you know, the sort of conformation of our skeletons, how those came to be, why we have, you know, 10 fingers and 10 toes, and why our arms are laid out the way they are, and the sort of, you know, the rib cage, the way that it contains so much but stops at a certain point, and how that's related to the locomotion of our ancestors, or even, you know, the bones that aren't there, the fact that, you know, we don't have bones in our eyes anymore. That got lost, you know, well over 200 million years ago. And, you know, thankfully, so I'd hate to go to the emergency room with a broken eye bone. But I think it's something that, you know, connects us not only to ourselves but to where we came from, and the sort of appreciate that we are these unusual biological marvels that didn't have to exist. You know, there was no sense of destiny that something like us ever had to appear. So it's, you know, recognizing our singular nature, but also, you know, connecting us through over, you know, 500 million years of evolutionary history, and, you know, what that means for how we came to be as we are.
That's Brian Sweetek. His new book is Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. He's going to be at the King's English Bookshop tonight at 7 o'clock, reading from the book, signing it as well. You can get details by going to our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.